Well, good morning, everybody. Brand new day, raining outside. We've got a change of government, and we are into class 32, I think, of the sermon material. It is class 32. So we'll take. Let's do a short breathing meditation. I'll set up the visualization, and then Miffy's going to take us through some recitations of refuge. And then I'll continue with the visualization until we get to starting the class. So please get comfortable in your seat. This basically means making sure that your back is straight and your shoulders are relaxed. You can keep your eyes open or close them and place your hands wherever they feel most comfortable. Now, as you allow yourself to breathe normally and naturally, become aware of the movements that take place in the body whenever you inhale or exhale. So by becoming aware of the movements anywhere in the body, we are focusing the mind and relaxing the body. So the body is relaxing more and more, and the mind is gently focused upon the movements that are taking place whenever you inhale or exhale. And it's from this perspective of having a relaxed body and a focused mind that you can easily imagine that all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and all the enlightened beings appear in the space above you. Think that in the center of this vast field of enlightened beings is the Buddha himself. And seated surrounding you are all sentient beings. And you recollect that what you have in common with all the people surrounding you is an equal wish to avoid suffering, to be happy, and yet neither of these wishes have been completely accomplished. We equally, all of us, lack genuine happiness. Nevertheless, the causes to bring about genuine happiness and to rid ourselves of the causes of suffering do exist. And we can find out how they exist and how to use our knowledge by relying upon the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas in front of us, their teachings, and them as a spiritual community. So let's take refuge now in the enlightened beings in front of us and generate the mind of enlightenment. So Miffy, would you like to do the rest?
I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dhamma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And dedicating especially our going for refuge on behalf of all sentient beings to their health and the very long life of Lama Zopa Rinpoche and all of our precious gurus.
Now, from the heart of the Buddha, rays of light and nectar move out through space and wash over you and over all the great crowd of people surrounding you. They remove all obstacles and hindrances to an authentic refuge and the generation of the mind of enlightenment. Now recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love and kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. And deciding to establish all beings within these four boundless states. Again, lights and nectars move out from the hearts of the Buddha in the refuge field above you. They wash over you and the crowd of people surrounding you. Everyone finds themselves with immeasurable loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. And seeing yourself in front of the refuge field, about to make prostrations and offerings and confession, we can recite the seven limb prayer together. So join with me. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the meritable, holy, and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now, to rid ourselves of the final vestiges of clinging to self, other, and the merits, we can make an offering to the refuge field in front of us. So here, briefly recollect that you yourself and all phenomena are empty of inherent existence. Through the body, dissolve into emptiness and reappear as a wonderful pure land that you can offer to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. And join me saying, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha field and offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam guru rakta mandala kanayatayami. So we release the offering, and the Buddha accepts it and smiles at us with delight. And we look up into the Buddha's eyes and we feel accepted and at ease. And now an emanation of the Buddha leaves his own heart, moves through space, and comes to the bottom above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. The emanation descends, entering the crown of your head, and coming down, down to the level of your heart, where it stops, and its brightness begins to increase, filling your body with light. Now the light goes out through the pores of your skin and fills the 10 directions of space. So the idea of a self and other has vanished, and the idea of inner and outer are recognized to be just ideas, and these ideas too have vanished. So resting within this vast emptiness, recognize you've established all beings into the enlightened state. There's no difference between yourself and anyone else. Allow yourself to feel happy about that. And then the light withdraws from the 10 directions of space and re-enters your heart. You feel yourself sitting on your seat and you're breathing normally and naturally. And you realize this has all taken place on the level of imagination. And it's set a propensity for you to actualize enlightenment for the benefit of others. And you breathe in deeply through your nostrils and exhale through your mouth and allow your eyes to flutter open and move your body in whichever way you'd like to feel at ease. Okay, so this we're going through these teachings on the Lam Rim Chenmo, which is the graduated stages of the path to enlightenment. It's also called a great treatise. So we're using this book, it's 1, 2, 3, fourth book along on the right, as this is a major text. We've been relying on a commentary by Kinsir Geshe Tashi Tsering. And also I've been relying a lot on this book called Steps on the Path to Enlightenment by Geshe Sopa. What we've been doing is basically going through the different questions that they've been setting. So today we are up to the section called Serenity and Insight. So serenity is another name for calm abiding meditation. And here we've got 22 questions and we'll be going through their answers. So if our first question is a simple one. It says, what is calm abiding? Or serenity. And basically it is a concentration which is imbued with a physical and mental bliss of pliancy, which you can place your mind on your object of focus in whatever way you please. So it really differentiates calm abiding or serenity from the previous states of concentration is this physical and mental bliss of pliancy. And as we go through the text, there'll be more about this bliss. Now, calm abiding is a very peaceful state of mind. And before we achieve that peaceful state of mind, there are some obstacles to that. So our next question asks, what are the main obstacles to the peaceful state of mind? And basically they are negative, discursive thoughts. So negative ideas and preconceptions. But Kinsa Rinpoche says it's through the influence of negative discursive thoughts we feel the need to fight others and create all sorts of different problems. Now, as you know, we're going through the last two sections in this the Great Treatise, and they're really dealing with these the two perfections of concentration and wisdom. And you know, we're up to a section asking, like, how do we train in the last two perfections? And the section is up is how to train in this. This is the main section. And each refers to what? So how to train in meditative calm abiding, how to train in insight, and how to unite them. And this section is divided into three sections again, which is what this is them. But so we come to this first one, how to train in meditative calm abiding. And again, you know, the question asks us, how's it divided again? So these questions, of course, can easily be answered just by looking at the text. So the first part is relying on the preconditions for meditative calm abiding. The second part is how to cultivate calm abiding on that basis. And the third section is the measure of successful cultivation of calm abiding. So probably we're going to start up with the first, relying on the preconditions for meditative calm abiding. And again, it's just a straightforward question that says, what are the six preconditions for calm abiding? So the first is to dwell in an appropriate area. The second, have little desire, and to be content. These two really go together, two and three. Completely giving up many activities, having a pure ethical discipline, and completely getting rid of thoughts of desire, etc. So these are sort of, we need to develop calm abiding, we require some inner and external preconditions. So most of the rest of the material, the text today, sort of goes through all the stuff here, asking, like, you know, what does it mean to dwell in any of these different things? Fran, you have a question?
So what if you find yourself in an inappropriate area and you've got no other option but to try and practice there? Is that like a really huge prerequisite or?
Well, let's go. I'll take you through the parts that make up the inappropriate area, Fran, and then we can see what would make it inappropriate and then what we could do about it. Okay. So here we go. So dwelling in an appropriate area is made up of these parts here, these five phenomena. So I'll briefly say something about each of them now, and then we'll go into a bit more detail as we go through the next five slides. So it says the area you're in should have five attributes, easy access, meaning so that necessities such as food and clothing might be readily obtained. So if it's difficult to get food, that would make it, you know, the area is difficult then, doesn't it? So food and clothing. Being in a good place to live where there are no wild beasts such as predators or enemies and so forth. So you might also think of barking dogs, a lot of roadworks.
Or fighting neighbours.
Fighting neighbours, yeah, that might sort of address you. Being on a good ground, so that in other words, so that sickness doesn't arise, you know, so you could think, well, okay, maybe I've got a place, but there's a lot of mosquitoes there. or Lyme disease. You know, so we don't want that sort of thing. Malaria, perhaps. So we don't want those. We need a ground that doesn't have those sort of things. Good companions. People who are ethically disciplined and like-minded, like yourself. So one of the things about when you do a calm abiding retreat, it's often said, you know, try and do it in the company of others. So if you're all, you can support one another. And then well-situated, the place should be well-situated. So there's not too many people about in the day and there's not so much noise at night. So now that was in brief. So now we'll take each of these and go into a little bit more detail.
Eddie, it strikes me that, a good hotel would be really perfect.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. So as you know, easy access so that necessities such as food and clothing may be readily obtained.
Everybody's out during the day.
Sorry?
Everybody's out during the day.
Well, let's come along to that. That comes up later on. So remember, there's five things here. So it's easy to get physically, to get the stuff you need, food and clothing, basically, right? Other necessities are easy to obtain. So second, you want a good place. Good place facilitates a serene meditative practice. So like Biffy's saying, like a hotel room up high up would be nice because you'd be looking out at the sky a lot of the time, wouldn't you? So there shouldn't be any wild animals, thieves, or hostile people or creatures who want to harm you. There should also be very few people who engage in wild or non-virtuous conduct. Therefore, you know, the yogis and the meditators often go to very quiet and secluded places, so they won't be disturbed. So, you know, we know of people who have done retreats in hotel rooms, and one of the things that they took with them were those noise-cancelling headphones. A good ground. So this is what I think about the sickness. A place is suitable for a long-term practice. So some of you might know there's some wonderful places overseas in Spain and France. So this is why I put this little picture in. This is refers to the environmental qualities of a place where the climate is very good, there's no diseases, and it's easy to adapt to the physical environment. And those are in places seem to be like a good ground. Good companions. So you want the people that are on the same page as yourself, ethical people, like-minded.
Eddie, can I just ask, with good ground, would that also include, say, being in a holy place or a place that is blessed? Is that specifically mentioned in there?
It doesn't. No, it's not.
That's interesting.
This is more to do with the physical aspects of the place and what sort of hinders you, makes it difficult. The good companions refers to the benefit of having the company of one, two, or more friends who are virtuous in their conduct and have a religious view that is harmonious with your own. The presence of such friends can be a great support to your practice. And lastly, well situated. There's not many people about the day and night. Your place must not be too busy or crowded. So, Fran, does this help in any way? Or like you're thinking about, you must have some specific difficulties.
Well, I'm just sort of wondering, obviously, if you're living in a war-torn country, it's going to be very hard to develop this practice, you know. Yeah, so. You know, so, and, you know, and we're, you know, I mean, when you live in Tibet now, you know, and you have those restrictions, you know, does it mean that you can't reach a state of calm abiding, or is it just that it's going to be really, really difficult to do?
I think all you've got to do is put up enough hindrances and ask yourself, can it be done? Especially for people at our level. Like if you think, well, imagine being in the Ukraine where the war is going, no, it's going to be very, very hard. Can't even get food and water, companions to do it. No.
All we have to do is turn on the TV and we're done for anyways.
Yeah, that's right, in the West. So now we're going to have a look at, so these were all just to do with the first point, right? We've got, I think, another 5 points to go. So these are all to do with dwelling in the appropriate area. Now we move on to the second point, having little desire. So it says here, be happy and satisfied with simple things. And the Lamrim Chenma says, you do not strongly crave more or better robes, etc. Rishi Sopra says, it's best to be happy and satisfied with simple things and to refrain from attachment to fancy and expensive things. Here, desire means excessive attachment to the possessions you already have. And unsatisfied desires is attachment to things you do not possess. And Lama Tsongkhapa gives the example of a monk who should be content with his old worn-out robes and not desire better ones. So here we go again. So like I said, these two points come together, being content and having little desire. But so these are very important for us. And these two should be a constant feature of our practice. And Kinsa Rinpoche was saying, especially for us as Westerners, is when things don't go our way, often creates lots of problems for us.
Eddie, so you put a picture of a coffee cup here, and I think that's quite good too, because on retreat, you know, your mind's going inwards and there's very little distraction, and so you can get quite obsessed about getting the right coffee, having the good lunch. You know, those your world concertina's in, but you still can get really obsessed about that rather than just, you know, letting it be.
Yeah, and so, you know, I would suggest if I'm doing a retreat, this is where the thing like easy access comes in. So before you do a retreat, you prepare, you know. So what I would do is if I found the best coffee that didn't make me jittery, I would get a lot of it and put it and keep it there. So I don't need any other types of coffee. I've got my coffee. So the next is called, so being content is crucial for achieving calm abiding. So I really want to think about it beforehand. Completely giving up many activities. We stop socializing, working, and entertaining. So as you said, Fran, you know, you don't want to have a television in your room when you're doing this, or probably even a computer that's hooked up to the internet. And if you're going to do a retreat, you know, and have a computer there, I'd suggest you probably maybe just have the Dharma material that you need for it and everything else not on it.
And you, Corey Jackson says you have your computer in a different room. It's no good to just have it off to the side, because if it's in the same room, your mind's still thinking about it. So you have it actually outside in a different room.
Yeah. So Gishi Sopa says, success in a meditative practice aimed at the development of shamatha or calm abiding requires you to give up certain worldly activities such as commerce or excessive socializing. Even certain activities that are generally considered virtuous, such as practicing medicine, can be hindrances to the cultivation of the state of calm abiding. The focus of the practice is single-pointed concentration. So developing it requires periods of intensive meditation practice. And these things like socializing, working, entertaining, perhaps even engaging in medical practice, they are actually distractions to the attainment of it. So having pure ethical discipline. So the interesting thing about this is that I always find this interesting. It's like whenever you make mistakes, which you are bound to do in terms of your vows you hold, you immediately address them and just restore the vow. That's what it means to keep pure ethical discipline, to restore the vow. So, yeah, and as you know from the text, Geshe gave the example of the snake, biting a snake suddenly in your lap. You know, you'd immediately throw it off your lap. So it's the same here. As soon as you find it, you've damaged the vow in any way, immediately respond to that and restore it on the spot. And some of you might remember that story of Lama Ratisha coming, leaving India and going to Tibet, you know, and it took a bit of time because he noticed that he kept breaking his tantric commitments all the way. So he'd have to hop down from the elephant, do the confession and hop up again, and away they'd go. And a little while later, he'd find, I've broken another tantric commitment. I've got to reestablish the vow. So that's a way of looking at it. So completely getting rid of thoughts of desire, etc. So we've got a couple of questions around this one. Well, this is the quote, one of the quotes that I took. They asked, like, you know, how would you go about doing that? What do we have to do to remove these thoughts of desire and so forth? It says everything in cyclic existence, everything in cyclic or is ephemeral and impermanent. Since it's certain I'll shortly be separated from all these, why should I crave them? So in this quote, there's a number of different ways of dealing with the thoughts of desire. Actually, there's like three different ways here. So you're given three methods here. Now, the first, simple one is just remember everything that you desire is impermanent and will disintegrate. You'll be separated from it in some way, being ephemeral. Focus on the unpleasant aspects of the object rather than the pleasant. That'll stop you having desire for it. And just remember that anything in cyclic existence cannot provide you with the happiness you're seeking. That's it in brief. But like I said, they ask these questions. So what do we do to remove thoughts of desire, etc.? So contemplate their disadvantages in this life and contemplate their disadvantages in the future. Geshe Sopa says you should meditate on how attachment and the negative karmic activities it propels can lead you to fall into a lower rebirth. Another antidote to thoughts of desire is to meditate on impermanence. All samsaric things, whether attractive or unattractive, are transitory. Recognize the impermanent nature of these things and the impermanent nature of ourselves will reduce the desire. So are there any questions so far up to this point here? So you know we've had a lot of lists and then we've got sort of into these preconditions for karma abiding. And that's where we're sort of basically up to. We've got a couple of more slides about the preconditions. Maybe I should do those, then we'll just have a pause there. This is what to give up.
Eddie, I think Francisco has a question.
Okay, Fran.
Not so much a question, but a comment, you know, but when we're talking about unplugging ourselves and I found that when we did the Noongnae over the New Year retreat, you know, literally unplugging myself for 3 days had an amazing effect, which lasted for months for me in terms of development of well-being. The only time I touched the technology was when we were doing our sessions, but for the rest of the time, being disengaged was really great. So I can imagine what everyone in Copan was doing for their 3 month Vajrasattva retreat, you know. But it's, I think it's important to, for your own concentration to be able to stop there.
I just recently bought a book, Fran, that that Corey had recommended, and it was about how what the social media and distraction has, what the effects on our psyche have. It's worrying, and I'm not surprised to see how we can, our mental health can be repaired if we can sort of unplug. But and the author who wrote the book, so he said that after like 7 days he went into withdrawal and he didn't even realize what was going on. And he said that's how much it had the effect on him, the physical effect. So basically, if you sum it all up, you know, what have we got to give up? It's basically this attachment to the pleasures of the desire realm. The reason for that is because calm abiding is a mind state of a realm that is higher than the desire realm. So if you hold on to the pleasures of the desire realm, there's no way you can achieve calm abiding. It's impossible. Yeah, so that's sort of serious. Now, this next question asks you, so there were six preconditions, which were the most important of them? And there are a couple of different answers I found. So having little desire, being content, and completely getting rid of thoughts of desire. So I can sort of see why these are here, because it's like they're really about attachment to the realm of desire, which prevents you achieving calm abiding. So from the Lam Rim Chenmo, the book itself, it says here, there, the most important ones are dwelling in an appropriate area, good ethical discipline, and seeing desires as disadvantageous. Then it also says that having little desire, being content, and completely getting rid of thoughts of desire are very important. So this is what Khinsa Rinpoche said. And then Geshe Sopa says, among the six, the most important are maintaining pure ethics, ridding ourselves of thoughts of desire, and dwelling in an appropriate place. So you have different teachers putting forward different ideas. Yeah, they're not all the same. Okay, so it's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Are there any sort of questions or anything you'd like to add, or was there anything unclear? If there is, please raise your hand or let us know where you want to say something. Okay, I'll move on to the next two slides, but this also, again, has a little section. So this question is about the lineage of the masters of calm abiding. So it's saying, you know, what lineage do they belong to? So before I put up the answer, could anybody wish to give me an answer? Somebody must know this.
Maitreya and Asanga.
Yep. So they are the major masters of the lineage. And what's the lineage called, Bruce?
Extensive deeds.
That's right, the lineage of extensive deeds. So that's the lineage. And then they ask, who are some of these masters, you know, by name? So here I've just put them up like this. So we know there are Maitreya and the Sangha, Maitreya being basically the head of the lineage, Asanga being his spiritual son, and then we have these other masters as well. Ratnakarashanti, Kamalashila, Baba Vaveka, and Haribhadra. Now, Geshe Sopa says these great teachers explained the method of practice from the perspective of the sutra path, but their explanations are also very helpful for tantric meditations as well. Now, again, we have another little section about the perfections now and how the perfections are causes for calm abiding. So in particular, we've got we're talking here, our class is really centered around the perfection of concentration and the perfection of wisdom. And it's basically saying that the four previous perfections are causes for calm abiding. How could they be causes for calm abiding? So the perfection of generosity helps us to disregard desire for possessions or to have more possessions and the attachment to those we already have. The perfection of morality or ethics helps us to live in, meaning we live in accordance with ethics. The perfection of patience allows us to take on the different hardships that will be involved in the development of calm abiding. And perfection of joyous perseverance means that we have an enthusiasm for virtue. So a little again from Geshe Sopa, he says, for example, when you perfect generosity, you do not seek things for your own benefit. Part of the perfection of patience is the ability to take on hardships for a wholesome purpose. Being well trained in pure conduct is the perfection of ethical discipline. It's not only knowing and taking vows, but also living in accordance with ethical guidelines. And the perfection of perseverance is a genuine enthusiasm for practicing the path and cultivating virtue. If you have these four perfections, the distractions and mental obscurations that hinder the cultivation of calm abiding are subdued. Your environment and mental state become much more conducive to successful practice, and you can achieve calm abiding much more quickly. And Kintsa Rinpoche said that, with these four perfections, the earlier ones act as causes for the latter ones, which are their effects.
So, Eddie, are they causes or are they supportive conditions?
There's no real difference between supportive condition. A supportive condition is a cause, and a cause can be seen as a condition. They use the same word in Tibetan for both.
Okay.
So now I have a similar type question, but now it's the question is really about the persons who are practicing the path and their capacity to practice. So the question is, how are the practices which are shared with the persons of small and medium scope important in the context of preparation for the cultivation of calm abiding? So when you had this quite long answer in this, but in brief, they provided excellent preparation for both, meaning calm abiding and the mind of enlightenment. Whoopsie. So again, from Geshe Sopa, he says, although shamatha or calm abiding does not require bodhicitta, it is important for Mahayana practitioners to set their motivation for the development of calm abiding to be for the benefit of all sentient beings. As they contemplate the best way to help sentient beings, we can see that cultivating calm abiding can be of tremendous assistance. So they begin serious practice of calm abiding for that reason and supported with that motivation. So Geshe Sopa again, he says, to meditate on bodhicitta or the mind of enlightenment, first engage in the meditations and practices that are in common with beings of small and medium scope. These set the foundation upon which practice grows. Like the beings of the small scope, you should meditate on the impermanence of this life, how this life has leisure and great qualities, but it is impermanent and it can be lost very easily and quickly. Our next life could be filled with acute suffering and contain fewer opportunities to progress on the path. Medium scope beings meditate on the pervasive nature of samsaric suffering. Here, we have to contemplate the way all sentient beings are subject to the truth of suffering and think about the true cause of suffering. Finally, we consider the way we can be of greatest benefit to all beings, and these contemplations help us to develop our mind of enlightenment. They're all excellent preparations for the practice of calm abiding.
And I think it's important to be able to put things into perspective, you know, because to a large extent it's not such a big mind shift for me in a lot of areas, but then when you sort of start talking about other stuff and particularly giving up attachment to things and equanimity and stuff, it's a very hard one to get our heads around. And I think sometimes, you know, you need to phone a friend and ask what you need to do, you know, so.
Yeah, that's right.
And just a clarification, I think, you know, because it's easy to sort of go off on the, you know, just the wrong path or pick up the wrong stuff and, you know, then you just, keep going, so.
Yeah, and Fran, actually bringing up a good point there, because one of those other ones of having good companions, so having people that are on a path of renunciation rather than a worldly path is so important, because otherwise those worldly things creep in really easily.
Oh yeah. my mission in life for the next couple of months is to sort of declutter myself, you know. I've had too much time looking away from everything going on, you know, being too busy with work and everything. But, yeah, so it's I think it's important sort of be able to step away, you know. But in the busyness of life, I mean, when you're young and you're having children and you've got to rear them and you've got to school them and everything, you need to function within it, you know. But it must be easier for us older people to develop renunciation and develop a desire.
Unless Fran, you start getting attached to grandchildren.
I haven't got any of those yet. We're just pretending the neighbours' ones are ours, you know. So
I
take on the thing that everyone's family, so, you know, you just treat them all the same.
So we've got this next. So we're now going to move into, I think, sort of actual calm abiding. So we're going to start pretty quickly with the posture and then the different problems that arise once you actually start meditating. So this has made of two parts. We've got the meditative posture and the process itself. What's the relevance of using the posture of Virachana? So, you know, I mean, I'm pretty sure you're all familiar with this posture. If you're not, well, we've got it in the next slide. But the relevance of it is that Verichara is seen to be the purified aspect of the aggregate of form. So the body that we have is an aggregate of form. The Buddha Verichara is said to be the deity who is the purified aspect of the aggregate of form. In other words, he is sort of the ideal for physical form. So that's why we try to hold our bodies in a posture that resembles it. Hence, we have this seven-pointed Verichara posture. Now, the seven-pointed Verichara posture can have eight elements. So it can have seven or eight. And I was just saying to Miffy how the order of these seven or eight often changes from text to text, and also what they actually put there as the points. So let's have a look at these, in this case, the eight elements. Now the first is these crossed legs. So you can see here, this is the what they call the fully crossed legs. This is probably for most of us, we can't do this. Right, so this is very important in terms of high yoga tantric practice. What we're doing with the sutra path, it's not so important. Other postures with the leg, it's more important to be comfortable. But this, in terms of Verichara posture, it's having these legs crossed like that with the feet are up on the opposite thigh. Then in terms of the eyes, it says your eyes should be neither wide open nor too far closed. And they should be fixed around the tip of your nose. So it's not like, as I say, actually on the tip. It should be just sort of, you keep going. Third is the spine should be straight. If you sit with your awareness directed inward, keeping your body straight without leaning too far back or being bent too far forward, or the other thing you can do is go too much to one side or not. One side or another, sorry. Fourth is to keep the shoulders straight and even. Five, do not raise or lower your head, nor turn it to one side. Set it so that your nose and navel are aligned. Next one. If you set your teeth and lips in their usual natural positions. Seven is to draw your tongue up close to your upper teeth. Now, the purpose for doing this is that you can start to drool the better you get at calm abiding. So that prevents that happening. And lastly, the breath itself. It says your inhalation and exhalation should not be noisy, forced, or uneven. Let it flow effortlessly, ever so gently, without any sense that you're moving it from here or there. And I know from my own experiences, this is not so easy to do. And I was saying to Miffy, she asked me before about one of the she got with the question saying, you know, it says before we should decrease our desire, and then the other one says that we should have no desire. I said, yeah, because like, you know, when you go into these meditations, it's not likely that we've already got rid of all of our desire, but we should be. Have made a lot of effort to decrease it. And then as we're making progress, we should do our very best to get rid of it altogether, if that's possible for us. And otherwise, we can't attain calm abiding. We'll attain some other state, but not calm abiding. So now we have this question about why is this posture, the posture of Verichara, seem to be the best posture? So I'm going to put up sort of five points to demonstrate it. So first, it's conducive to developing pliancy. So in Venerable Asanga, one of his texts was called Sravaka Levels. He gives five reasons for sitting as the Buddha Varachana, cross-legged. So it says the body, this posture in which the body is pulled together well, is conducive to the arising of pliancy. So you will develop pliancy very quickly. Sitting in this way makes it possible to maintain the posture for a long time. The posture does not lead to physical exhaustion. Third, this posture is not common to non-Buddhists and the opponents of Buddhism. When others see you sitting in this posture, they are inspired. And fifth, the Buddha and his disciples The Buddha and his disciples used this posture and bestowed it upon us. This posture taught to disciples, they achieved high realizations by practicing in this way. I went on to teach. So this is a proper and effective posture. So like I'm saying, for many of us, we won't be able to cross our legs in that particular way, but the rest we should be able to do.
Eddie, so Francesca said, oh, it looks like it's Maitreya's posture for me.
That's right. Okay, so now our next question. So in the section, so that's the posture. Now we come to the meditative process. Of course, it's made up of different elements. And the question is, what elements do we need to understand in order to attain calm abiding? These are listed in the introductory passage. So like what are they? So they're simply these two things. So the five faults and the eight antidotes. So this is one method of describing how the practice of calm abiding is attained. The second way of explaining it is using the six powers, the four types of attention, and the nine mental states. Now, you can bring these two together, because they go together. But when we first hear the method explained, it's best to hear it one at a time. So many years ago, I went to Sydney to take a teaching by His Holiness Chodron Rinpoche, and he was explaining calm abiding. And that's what he did. So I thought, wow, that is so clear. Just do the five faults, eight antidotes one day. Then he did the six powers, four types of attention, and the nine mental states the second day. And then the third was like how to put them together. And there's a lot of material about these two techniques here. And no doubt, as we go through the text, we'll be going through each of these. So our next question is, what are the two parts of the explanation of the meditative process? So we begin by how to develop a flawless concentration and the stages, followed by the stages in which the mental states are thereby developed. So we begin by how to develop this flawless concentration. And this has to do with, I think, the five faults and then the eight antidotes we need to bring to them. So at the beginning, we need to remove laziness. So there are different types of laziness. And this is the laziness where we feel disinclined to cultivate calm abiding. And so we don't want to give up the things that are conducive to calm abiding. Geshe Sopa says, in order to produce a faultless karma body, you need to be free of the five obstacles to its achievement. Any spiritual practice requires you to train your mind over long periods of time. Now, laziness or not wanting to exert effort in practice is the first obstacle. So it's important to remove it. But again, Geshe Sopa, laziness has many forms. In general, a lazy mind is not overtly attracted to unwholesome actions, but neither is it enthusiastic about virtue. One type of laziness, this one here, is not wanting to do a particular practice. You might have an interest in it, but laziness takes over, and so you don't make any effort in the practice. Still, there are others who are so enthralled with worldly distractions that they have no strong wish to achieve karma bhati or meditative stabilization. So there's, you know, these two forms of laziness. One being really enthralled with distraction, worldly distraction, and the other just having really no interest in it.
So, Eddie, then the go-to ways to remove laziness would be one, to remember death and impermanence, like to, you know, have in our mind, oh, the threat that, well, we won't be able to get to do it after all. Yeah. And then to the incentive then is for the benefit of others. So, you know, one is the threat, oh, it might be taken away from us, this opportunity, and then the incentive is, wow, I'm going to be able to help others if I can do it. Is that?
Yeah, you can say that's right. Before we said about how the mind of enlightenment helps us to develop karma bhati. So we've got to find, you know, there's got to be some incentive here for us.
Yeah.
And that's where we really look at the benefits of karma bhati. So we start off with the aspiration to achieve Buddhahood. You work it out, you go, my God, I'll have to develop my mind. I'll need to concentrate my mind. Without the mind being concentrated, I won't be able to even develop the mind of enlightenment, let alone achieve karma bhati. So this type of laziness of just not wanting to do it, like I said, we've got to find the benefits, remember the benefits of doing it. Now, there are four remedies for laziness within the context of karma bhati. So, you're probably all familiar with them: faith, aspiration, perseverance, and mental pliancy. These are the four antidotes. So mental pliancy, the fourth, is the result of the previous three. And it's developed by having faith, aspiration, and perseverance. You do the three, and as a result of that arises this pliancy. So a persevering mind, in the Buddhist context, is one that is enthusiastic about virtue. The real antidote to laziness is the perseverance that takes joy in practicing meditation. When you can eliminate laziness through the application of perseverance, your body and mind spontaneously begin to express enthusiasm for practice. The fatigue of laziness ceases, and your body becomes subtly joyful about this state. This physical pliancy is most helpful in meditation. So I think for most of us, when we make attempts at meditation, it doesn't take long before the body starts aching in all sorts of different places. Through the development of these different stages of concentration, through having persevering, that diminishes and the body becomes more pliant. This was our last question for our of the 22 questions. Is there anything anybody would like to bring up or ask before we just briefly go over the summary and do the last prayers together?
Just me here, Eddie. How do we know we're doing enough? You know, is there a scorecard? Is there a way of making that decision, or do we need somebody else to mirror it to us? Or how do we persuade ourselves that we've gotten to this point?
Yeah. So when you say this point, you mean?
They just remedies for laziness, you know, with getting through that.
You actually want to meditate.
Right.
You want to do this.
Can you become attached to meditating?
Is to become enlightened for the benefit of others. So you can't be attached with that. Corey Jackson comes here, you know, to give teachings, and we listen to him online. So he's like, his partner said to him, you finish your PhD and you can go off and do the retreat. And that's what he just wants to go and do a retreat. He just, because he's done meditations before on this type of calmly abiding, he's had some of the different experiences, and he knows. You know, so because you know something, you know, you have more enthusiasm. So knowledge comes out of the faith. And then aspiration, I want to do this, I want to do this. So, of course, you persevere, and it sort of builds. These first three, they sort of build on one another, Francesca. So how are you going, Dawn? Is it okay?
Eddie? Is meditation the best practical remedy for laziness?
I could say yes, but then you have to get the meaning of meditation. So meditation just means to be familiar with something, or to cultivate something.
Okay.
So the thing that you are becoming familiar with or cultivating has to be something that really interests you, that you really want to do. And that's the thing that overcomes the laziness.
Okay.
It gives the ability to persevere, to continue on. Because it's something you want to, you know the benefit of it.
Yes.
And you know that, like, if I want to have that benefit, I have to do something about that. I need to act in some way. And so that acting is the meditation part.
It's very hard when you're in that circle of laziness, so to speak, isn't it?
Yep, that's right.
Yes.
And laziness is this thing here, it doesn't see any benefit for you.
Correct. Correct.
So this is the thing, though, we've got to go, well, actually, there's a lot of benefit for me, and remind ourselves of it. And then
yes.
When we sit down to do the meditation, in your motivation, tell yourself, I'm doing this for this reason. And when you finish, great, I did it for this reason. I'm getting closer. And it's also good, Dawn, to not do long sessions.
Okay.
Otherwise you get tired and it's discouraging. Do shorter sessions so you know, I can do that. I can do that. And then it encourages you to go back.
Yes, yes. All right. Thank you, Eddie.
You're welcome. How's our friend Jeanette? You had something to ask too, Jeanette? You got to click the little thing so we can hear you.
No, I was just going to comment on your enthusiasm, that you need to have the enthusiasm for meditation. I feel that I want to do meditation. I would really and like to be able to do it, but I've got a great fear of doing it. And remember in the last class, I told you about it. I just got a horrible experience twice. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But actually, since the last class, I took my book down off the shelf, that Jack Kornfield book that's about meditations, all led by someone. You're not just doing it on your own.
Okay, yeah.
It's led. What's the right word for it?
Sorry?
What's the right word for a meditation you do, but it's somebody else is speaking like what you do?
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, somebody else is leading you through it.
It's right. A guided meditation.
Guided.
So, yeah.
My goodness, I can't think of worse these days. So I made a bit of progress getting the book down, thinking I might try it again.
Yeah.
Haven't been able to do it.
So what's the meditation on? What's he leading you through?
Well, it's a book of guided meditations on every aspect. There's impermanence and death, loving kindness, compassion.
Okay, so which was the one that you tried to do? Which one was the one that he led you through?
I didn't do any of his. The one that I did that I got trouble with was just listen to a tape, a meditation tape of music that's supposed to calm you down. And,
right, yeah.
And I got this feeling that I was spinning off into the air. And I was way up in the sky, in my chair, up in the sky.
Yeah, okay.
So I opened my eyes because it was such a fright.
Yeah, so...
And the other one that I did was... I can't remember how this one came about, but I lost my arms and my legs. And I just felt as if, ooh, scary. There's nothing there. I'm gone.
Yeah.
That really scared me.
Yeah. Okay, so here, Jeanette, I'm trying to use these words like when we say meditate, right? So you go like, what is meditate? If you say to you, so I was trying to explain to you what meditation is. Right. Then I go, okay, Jeanette, explain meditation to somebody. What are you doing? What are we doing? If somebody said to you, if your children said to you, Mum, what are you doing when you're meditating? What would you say?
You're trying to train your mind.
Okay. Meditation is cultivating or becoming familiar with something.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing I'd ask, so what are you cultivating? What are you becoming familiar with?
Virtue.
Right. So it's not the music, right, that scared you. That's not your meditation. This is something else you would have put on to do something, I don't know, but you got scared. That's not the meditation we're talking about here.
You're talking about a higher type of concentration.
Absolutely.
You're talking about a higher type of meditation.
So I'm just talking about meditation, cultivating a mental state or familiarizing ourselves with a mental state. So when we do, if you were doing calm abiding, you could just cultivate a familiarity with your breath if you chose to, a neutral object, right, to help you just notice how much activity you've got on and calm down. Right? So you're becoming familiar with the process of calming down. You're cultivating calm state.
Mm.
Right? And you're going to become familiar with it. And you are familiar with it because you know, this is how I do it. That's meditation, one type of meditation. So then you get a nice calm state. Once you've got the calm state, you can think in a particular way, or you listen to somebody directing you in a particular type of meditation. And then you're going to go like, what meditation? And you know it's this meditation. You'd ask yourself, what's the purpose of that meditation? What am I going to become familiar with when I listen to that? What am I cultivating when I listen to that two or three times? What's the mental state? You understand?
Yeah.
So this is the thing. It's not when we're in the lamb room, like so much is known beforehand. All we have to do is do it. What's required from us is to understand beforehand what is the point of the meditation. What am I familiarizing myself with? What am I cultivating? Why? What's the point?
Mm.
And Eddie, often like the if we sit and just be quiet and listen to music, that's not actually a meditation, but it's relaxing. It's like it can be a preparation. But when we're sitting and listening to music, what are we actually focusing on? What are we becoming familiar with? So often it's just used to help us relax, but it may not actually have that effect on us anyway.
Yeah, as you discovered.
Yeah,
it
really stressed me out.
Yeah, that's right. So what's happened here, Jeanette, is you go, okay, so I got really stressed out by this particular meditation. Now I'm scared of all meditation.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But this is what I'm saying. These meditations are land rim. They've got no music in them. They are ideas to cultivate and familiarize ourselves with, so we take the next step and we take the next step. It's called, you know, steps to leading to enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't, you know, like each step we cultivate is to lead us to the next step. You know, so for instance, you know, when we do the meditations on death and impermanence, and the death leading to the lower realms. So a lot of people don't like them, so I get scared. And you say, great, because that's what's meant to happen. If you are scared, you got it. Move on.
Yeah, but I think it's a different kind of scared with me. I'm scared of loss of control. I'm not in control any longer.
Ah, well, see, this is what, so this is, the Lamb Room is about taking control and stepping in line with the steps that have made before. You are in control of the whole process. That's what I'm saying. It's like the meditation is the process of cultivating and becoming familiar with mental steps that you know what the outcome is and why you want that outcome. We're not going into the dark here. We're not knowing what's, I mean, there's going to be an experience you don't quite know what it is, but you've got a great general idea of what the point of having the experience is.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like with calm abiding, we're saying, so why one of the questions we could ask ourselves is, why do I want to cultivate states of concentration? For yourself, just so I can control my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I maintain control of my mind. I decide what I'm going to think, when I'm going to think it, and which direction the mind goes in.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah, for sure. Great. And it's beneficial for you and for Willie and your children and everyone else. It's tremendous. Yeah, and like without it, all of our virtues remain weak. So why? Because we're so easily distracted.
Yeah, you know. I have to have a good think about it.
Yeah, well, good. That's what you
start at the bottom and start at the bottom and work my way up again.
I say, write to me whenever you want to. Like the idea, I'm trying to use these terms like Corey uses, just get out of the sphere of like religion or spiritual stuff. Let's just get down on the ground here and talk about basically what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We're more likely to have a go.
Yeah, I'll have a go. I will. Sorry, everybody.
Okay, so anybody else like to say anything before we leave?
Yeah, Eddie, just you said, I think, that the faith, aspiration and perseverance build mental pliancy, but it's interesting that given mental pliancy, mental and physical pliancy, kind of what you achieve at the kind of the ninth stage of calm abiding, to have it as a remedy for laziness, I just can't quite trying to understand that.
Okay, so there's a great section of a book called Walking Through Walls that explains that. So, like, the pliancy is like, it's accomplished at the ninth level, But to have the accomplishment, it goes through these three. It's like it's a result. So for the result, you have to have the causes. But as it's going through, it's developing until it's fully flourishing at the ninth level. It just can't just pop out of the blue.
No, that's right. Everything
came before it. But you're quite right. It's quite interesting.
Yeah.
Sure it is.
But it seems to indicate that you carry faith, aspiration, and perseverance as causes in themselves along the way. Not specifically as remedies for laziness, but it's sort of like you maintain a faith in the practice as you go along the levels, and aspiration, you know, bodhicitta aspiration and perseverance, because you won't get to the ninth level without it.
So there's three types of faith here. So this is just the first one for when we to begin. Right? Then the faith changes. There's two and three others that go through the aspiration and the perseverance. So we're sort of going we persevere and then we need more faith. So it's like going backwards and forwards, and this is giving us the pliancy. Like I said, but like I said, Caroline, is a really good explanation in the Walking Through Walls book, and there's another quite a thick one too on this woman, Sibylle Zala, Meditative States. It's interesting.
Thanks.
Okay, so let's go on. So we basically went through 22 questions today. We looked at their answers, and basically it's been focused around these last two perfections. So the next time we see each other, not next week, but the week after. So this is, you'll have read from pages 33 to 39 in terms of the stages of the path to enlightenment by Lama Tsongkhapa, the major book. Geshe Thachi Tsering's commentary will be teaching 20. And if you have Geshe Sopa's book, it's volume 4, 53 to 68. Okay, so let's dedicate our efforts. So recollecting that because we've made effort being a dependent arising, it is empty of any intrinsic existence. And we who depend upon a body and mind and the name I lack inherent existence because we dependently exist. Buddhahood also depends upon the path, so it's also empty. So we dedicate the merits of these virtuous actions to quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. And may the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore, such that as long as space abides and as long as sentient beings abide, we will abide to dispel the suffering of others. Okay, everybody. Thank you for being here for me on Sunday.